Good morning, everybody. Thanks for joining us so early. We're gonna try to leave time for a lot of questions at the end of this panel as well, so we can have some interaction. If anybody has not picked up breakfast or coffee, there is some available diagonally across this main hallway here in the ballroom. Let me introduce our speakers. First, to your left, McNelly Torres, and she is one of the directors of the Florida Center for Investigative Journalism, a new investigative nonprofit in this region.
Thank you, Frenchie.
Next from me, to my right, Manny Garcia, editor of El Nuevo Herald. And to his right, to his left, to your right, it is early, isn't it? Is Pia Malbran, who's investigative producer for CBS News.
Thank you, Keith. And it's Florida Center for Investigative Reporting. A little correction there. Anyway, we're still trying to wake up after last night. So, guys, I guess most of you know that there's breakfast. I was told that I have to plug this in every other, couple of minutes. So I want to do a quick survey before I get started. How many people from Florida that are here besides Frenchie? Okay. So we got quite a few. Okay. Well, the environmental beat is a very exciting beat, but I think that when it comes to records, it's one of those beats where you really need to develop a discipline. And at IRE, which is the Investigative Reporters and Editors Organization, I'm a member, have been for a long time, and we all are. We always talk about, developing a record set of mind. And this is a discipline. When you look at records, you have to probe them, understand them. You also need to be organized when you're working on a project. Sometimes you can become very overwhelmed when you're looking at lots of records, especially when you're talking about paper records. Just last week, I was looking at a decade of records on a facility. Trust me, it's not pretty, but you just have to be very disciplined about it. Be curious. I mean, curiosity, asking questions is very, very important. I always say that playing dumb is a very good thing. It has always served me well all these years because, seriously, nobody likes a smart-ass reporter, okay? If there's something that you guys don't understand, since I have this very heavy, thick Puerto Rican accent, feel free to raise your hand. Or if not, wait for the end, because we're going to leave plenty of time for questions. I'm going to quickly talk about databases that you guys should know about. And I'm going to go really fast on this because, I need to leave time for my colleagues here. Obviously, if you're covering the environment, you should know about the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. They have a lot of data there. One particularly that I really, really like, and everybody should know about this, is the Enforcement Compliance History Online, which we call ECHO. It's a database that has inspections, enforcement for clean water, air, and hazardous waste of over 800,000 plus facilities. It's tons of information. It's very, very helpful. You should always, trust but verify too. They'll usually have things at the federal level and also all the enforcement at the state level. And then you can go to the state agencies and then try to verify a lot of that information and get the records. I'm going to show you an example of how a searching window looks like. Like this one here, we have to search the air program. Another good database is the toxic release inventory. Even though this database is old, it really has a wealth of history, and it's very good if you want to study and write about, something. It's a good source. God, I need to see this thing. And you can do searches by zip code and pull out information on this. Here on I pull up the state of Florida on the website, on the EPA website. You can also look like little snapshots of your state, and it has a lot of really useful information. You can see that here on this, you know, it has all kinds of, you know, pollutants or different discharges, whether, you know, to the air, to water. You can search a lot of that stuff there. Another agency that you should be very, very aware about, because when there's an explosion or there's a huge accident, you know, one of the agencies that we go to is the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. Yes, this agency has been notoriously underfunded, but you can find, even on their website, you can find a lot of information about inspections and, you know, violations and, you know, fines that there were issued. And then you can go locally and trying to get that, you know, little close-up of that in records. If you are in Florida, obviously, you need to know about the Department of Environmental Protection. There's a lot of good information on their website. You know, I dealt with them over the years here, and they're very helpful, although, you know, we have a new governor, and he tends to be difficult. But but you can download a lot of really interesting data from the website, especially anything that has to do with petroleum cleanup and underground petroleum tanks. I did a lot of those stories when I was at the Sun Sentinel a couple years ago, and it's very, very useful. This other searching engine that they have at the state level, which I love, and they are expanding this. They are adding more and more records on this database. And what they do have here is basically everything on the underground petroleum tanks, individual cases, if there have been any leaks, every piece of record on each case, you can find it here. But for these Florida folks who are sitting in the audience, download the help guide so you can get acquainted, because it's not that user-friendly, and they're expanding that. How am I on top of time? Are you guys keeping track of time? Any of you? Am I doing okay? The other department that, if you're in Florida, and I'm assuming that a lot of states obviously have this regulator at the state level, is the business professional regulation. Even though the state environmental officials regulate all the companies that are, you know, that are environmental companies that deal with environment, they, you know, sometimes you've got facilities that have subcontractors and, you know, do different things. So you must find out about them, and, you know, you never know. I love to dig up on people, and I love to dig up on companies and the people behind them, especially, you know, trying to find out in relationships with local officials. That's where the good stories, you know, come up all the time. So in order to operate here in Florida, a lot of these companies need to get a license. So you can find out a lot of that information. The other part that I want to quickly just touch on is on data. I mean, I love data, and I think the data, you can do so much. And when you put the online component there, and I always seen online as an extension of my work in the newspaper when I was a newspaper reporter, which I'm no longer a newspaper reporter. And I always will look at, you know, how can I present this data? Because you can show patterns, but this is also information that you are providing to the audience, and it's just, you can do a lot of things. I think sky's the limit when it comes to the internet. Seriously. This is something that we did with the petroleum leaks a couple years ago, and we just really downloaded all the stuff on Google Maps and showed the three-county area, Palm Beach, Broward, and Miami-Dade. It was really interesting to see all these oil leaks now, you know, that we have this BP huge thing that happened. You know, how long has it been since that happened? Like a year, 2 years ago? I think 2 years ago, right? The BP oil leak, was it 2 years ago? Can anybody remind me? 1 year? 1 year. God, I'm getting old. So that was the front page story. So if there's anything that I want you guys to think about as I close my presentation, and I think I'm breaking record here, is that to me, environmental stories are about people. You know, how it affects people, it affects their health, even their ability to, you know, to have an income. This is a story that I did years and years ago. It is such a classic example of digging and having a discipline to look at records. And at the time, I was just really looking at these permits for these hog farms. And what I found out was that the state officials were working with the farmers and telling them how to take advantage of a loophole on the law. And they were cheating, and it was unbelievable what they were doing. You know, they were even calculating, doing bad math, you know, like hog average weight on the farms, and that was like a huge thing because it will affect of how all the environmental laws apply to that specific facility. And, you know, for months and months and months, this farmer who was at the center of this huge scandal and controversy, and I was covering at the local level and at the state level because legislators were revising those laws. He refused to talk to the media for months and months and months and months. And I finally got to talk to him, and I follow this issue. Sometimes you got to follow this thing, you know, for a long time and to see results. But it's just really worth it. That's a hog farm. I stopped eating pork for a year when I was covering this stuff. I just got disgusted. 2 years ago, there was a huge explosion in Puerto Rico at the refinery. And I have friends there. I was born and raised in Puerto Rico, but I have never worked there. So to me, it was very personal when this happened. And I just happened to have some journalist friends who work there, and they work in a nonprofit too, just like us. So I called Omaya and I said, "What do you need?" Well, we worked for 2 weeks and put together an investigation on what happened, and this company, refinery, and everybody who's been behind, and all the violations, which you know amounted to millions of dollars, and it was just unbelievable what you can do when you dig up records and you find information, and then you go to people and you find more information. It's just like peeling an onion, you know, back and forward. So I hope this was useful. We have a handout. There's more websites that I put on the handout. I hope that you find that very useful. Thank you very much. And I'm just going to pass it to Keith.
Thank you, McNally. And we'll have time. We're going to save plenty of time for questions and back and forth and some of the specific sites and places to go for records and so forth. We'll have plenty of time to follow up even individually afterwards. So don't worry about trying to get every item. McNally has given a nice overview now of having that sort of data mindset and thinking about what records may be available. Okay, so now you've got this wonderful idea in your head for a story. Now we're going to take you back into the practical aspect of this again. How do you pitch that to your editor? How do you actually prepare yourself so that you can actually be able to do what you just think you've discovered? Manny Garcia, he's the editor of the El Nuevo Herald.
You guys hear me?
I'll try this mail here.
Thank you. Good morning. Like McNally, I'm with investigative reporters and editors. I'm on the board, and this year I'm fortunate to be the president of IRE, and it's an organization that changed my career. It really did. It's the best thing that happened to me. So what I want to talk to you about is something that happens to all of us, and whether you're a reporter or as an editor, you have a great project idea that you want to do. So I'm going to use the best practices of what I've gone through over my years to help you, whether you're a reporter or as an editor, streamline your project, focus, and deliver it. First of all, what I would focus on is, what's your story idea and what is your dream lead? Or what is, if you're doing it for radio or you're doing it for television, what's going to be that opening portion that's going to capture everyone? So the way we approach it at the Herald is, for example, I would ask you to write a memo to say, what is your dream lead? And the reason I want you to write a memo is simply because when you're writing down your thoughts and ideas and how you want to do this, you're going to begin to find the holes in your proposal. And that's key. That's not necessarily bad. That's actually good because it'll help you get to what's the reporting you need to do. One of the, what we all face nowadays, it's the managing and juggling of your beat. Some of us have 3 months, 4 months to do a project. Most of us do not. I'll give you a quick example. I have, for all of you who work down here, there's a reporter on El Nuevo Herald named Enrique Flor. So Kika is doing a story on the city of Hialeah, and he hears that the city of Hialeah in certain areas has major problems with flooding. And he heard that the city of Hialeah spent millions of dollars on a pump system to eliminate flooding. And so I said, Kike, what is your dream lead? Well, that the city of Hialeah spent millions of dollars with an unqualified vendor and the pump doesn't work. I'd read that, especially in a cash-strapped city. So Kike set out to prove that. So what did he have to do? Again, he's a beat reporter who's also covering murder and mayhem in South Florida. So organize yourself to see whether you have a day or several hours during the day to sort of do reporting, do pre-reporting on. It's what we call foraging. And what you do is figure out, first of all, one of the first things you should do with your project, has it been done before? And that's key because it's not necessarily bad if a project's been done before, because you can always try to find a new wrinkle. And by reading somebody else's work, it'll help you sort of give you a guidepost of how a project was done. So next is what I call the sourcing. And that's going to be the human sources, the people that you will need to stand up what you believe is your story. Sources is also going to be documents as well as, for example, in documents, if you're covering a beat or you're going to do an environmental project, one of the main things you want to ask for, every government agency gets audited. Remember, checks and balances are going to be your friend. So when you go to an organization or a group, you want to ask, who audits you? And then you want to go to that agency and pull audits. It's no different than when the BP oil spill, the explosion, BP was audited, Transocean was audited. We now know afterwards that you had MMS, Materials Management Services, whatever that the Washington agency is, basically was like they didn't do anything. But the point is that that leads to other stories. So then what you're doing is when you're writing that memo, again, focusing on like, has it been done before? Who do I need to talk to stand that up? In Kika's case, he ended up finding engineers for the city of Hialeah, and he ended up finding the procurement contracts because it had to be put out to bid. The long and short of it, he ended up finding that the contract was put out to bid. It was given to an unqualified bidder. That was even in the document. It was an unqualified bidder, but however, they were the low bidder who assured the city of Hialeah that they could do the work. Then he talked to the procurement folks who told him, well, we did it this way, but we did warn the council that they're not the most qualified, but they assure us that they can do the work. Long and short of it is, the pump was built at $5 million plus cost overruns. So also remember, you want to follow the money trail with everything on documents. So look at the steps, which they call the draws, financial draws on contracts. And every agency has that, and that's available through the specific department who's got the work, who's responsible for the work being done, but also in the city's finance department. Because remember, government or cities, government, local, state, municipal, federal, who writes the checks? And that's who you want to establish. It's like pointing the finger and saying, ma'am, do you write the checks? Walk me through that. Because that way you'll be able to follow the money. Long and short of it, his story, his lead did stand up, which turned into a display page one story that I'll talk more about. That was the city of Hialeah gave a no-bid contract to an unqualified vendor to build a $5 million water pump system to ease flooding, and it doesn't work. The story only got better because it didn't just not work, but when they ran it, the thing started flooding. It's like, just imagine the plumbing in your house just spitting out water. That's what happened. So then once you've got your memo, you'll have one of the hardest jobs you have as an editor or as a reporter is to decide, is the story there or not? An editor told me a long time ago, you want to get somebody or you want to get an agency for, you know, the analogy is you want to get somebody for robbing a bank. You don't want to get them for stealing candy. So if the project is not there, that's a discussion that you have with your editor. And the best way to do that, frankly, think about your own newsrooms, how busy things are. When I was able to pitch my projects to my editors, I tried to get a meeting with them first thing in the morning, preferably out of the office, for coffee, because that's before they go into the office and they're signing on to these things, and the world just, you know, how things come unglued in the newsroom. Get them early, get them together, present your plan of attack. If the project is not there, if the project, don't throw your notes away. Keep things because you never know when things will come up. For all of you who have worked in this town, there was a commissioner who passed away, shot himself in the Herald's lobby, R. Teal. The Herald had looked into a city agency that he had overseen for years and could not get the story. Then five years later, a new reporter came on the beat. A bunch of us had kept the documents, handed it over to the beat reporter, and we found out that the commissioner had been stealing from this agency in the city of Miami. So always keep your documents. You never know what's going to come back. Another thing that you want to look at is, can you do the project yourself, or is it best to partner with somebody who may bring a level of expertise? So is there someone in your newsroom, you know, and as an editor, you've got to decide, is somebody a lone wolf or are they not? So you've got to decide, is it better to work two together or do it yourself? Then you want to focus on time. Time management is very important. Your editors are going to be very focused on that, and you want to make sure you're productive. So get yourself a chart. Just imagine how much time. Give yourself a deadline when you hope to deliver that story. And that's key. And then start working backwards from there. It's what you call a back-out schedule. As Peter will talk about, in the modern realm of multimedia, you want to find your protagonist. And you have to have a protagonist because that's going to be the lead, the person who's going to carry your story. In print, on radio, and on TV. And remember, newspapers now are doing videos, and so almost, and we're doing documentaries. The Herald did a project some years ago called House of Lies, which was how developers were receiving money to build affordable housing. They were not building affordable housing. They were stealing the money. So the Herald found a woman named Ozzie Porter who had saved her pennies, had saved her money, put a down payment on affordable housing, and the developer stole the money so he can build himself a mansion in South Miami. So we rented a helicopter and took a picture of the mansion. Meanwhile, we had Ozzie Porter walk through the vacant lot of where her house was supposed to be built and talking about her dream home with the pink walls for her daughter and how she had worked two jobs to save the money. Tell me anybody doesn't want to read that. When we put that on video on our website, the county freaked out, and they said, we've got a big problem on our hands. Again, you know what it is? Ozzie Porter became the protagonist. Identify your protagonist. Again, report with your senses. You have to think multi-platform, and you want to expand your reach. It's huge because it's about the biggest bang for your buck on a story. radio, television, print, Facebook, Twitter. You want to send your story out because it's not just the impact that your story is going to have, but remember, what's key? It's the tips and leads that are going to come in. Tips and leads that are coming in. When the space shuttle blew up, we were writing stories out of New Orleans where they made the fuel tank for the space shuttle. I'll never forget this. I was sitting at a Ruby Tuesdays. I filed a story from a Ruby Tuesdays in Louisiana, and my story went up on the website. Within minutes, I was getting emails from people in Mississippi telling me, you got to go visit this scientist at the Stennis Space Center. You got to go to Mississippi. Again, it's your story. It's what's coming in, too. You're going to get a ton of documents doing these projects, but remember, cull the documents. You don't want to throw everything up there. Choose only the best, most impactful documents. And what you want to pull, remember, when you have those beautiful quotes, don't waste them. Do, if you're able to do it, if you're doing a newspaper story, make sure there are pull-out quotes in the paper. Pull-out quotes. Same thing on the website. The best soundbite. Keep only the best in there. To wrap it up, you also want to have what I call peer review on your projects. We seek out the best experts on whatever we're doing, and we want somebody to vet our project. For example, we did a project on sentencing in Florida some years ago, which looked at specifically that there was racial disparity in sentencing. We created a program, an entire database, and wrote a project. The database that we created, the analysis, we sent it to a doctorate, a professor at the Florida State University. We sent it to two of them, and we sent it to them and says, we want you to vet our methodology. In essence, you want somebody to impeach it, shoot it down. That's important. And you want to show your cards with your project. You want to send it to whoever you're going to write about and say, here's my findings. Corroborate it or shoot it down. It's better to do that than get criticized after it runs. It's better to vet things and make adjustments. On the sentencing project that I'm telling you about, we had to go back and make some adjustments to our work, but it was very important because it made the project stronger and it was unimpeachable. The last thing I'll say before moving on here, it's on these peer review, you want to flat out ask your experts, are you paid by industry? Because you don't want to be in a situation that you're using an expert and then you find out later on, are they paid by industry? And then finally, it's what I want to talk about, it's collaborations. In the modern world, you may not be able to do the project yourself, but seek out organizations that you can work with or organizations that are producing really good work that you can collaborate or work with. We do work with Univision. That's our partner, naturally. Our Miami Reporter does work with America TV, which is a local station here. The Center for Public Integrity, Florida Center for Investigative Reporting, and ProPublica are some of the groups that we team up with. But seek collaboration because there's strength in numbers. And with that, I'll pass it on.
Thank you, Manny. Next we have Pia Malbron. She's investigative producer at CBS News. And now that we've heard a little bit about sort of getting the records mindset, and Manny's given some ideas about whether you're an editor or reporter, what you need to do to actually accomplish that story you're seeing. Manny mentioned the importance of trying to do things and think of things in multimedia ways, including video. Just about everybody is shooting video now, and sometimes people are collaborating on video. And now that leads me to Pia, who's going to show you now how you take a story and make it compelling on air. Pia.
Hi. Can everyone hear me? A little loud. So as Keith said, I'm an investigative producer with CBS News. I produce stories that air primarily on the CBS Evening News. And I'm going to talk about how to make a story visual, because I know, as Manny mentioned, a lot of print folks are also doing video now for websites. To begin, what an investigative story. What is an investigative story? Really, everyone should be doing investigative reporting. It's original reporting. Those of us who specialize in investigative reporting, what we aim to do is sort of one of two things. We aim to generate new stories, stories that no one's ever heard of before, or covering a topic that no one's covered before, or we present a different angle to a story that everyone else is doing. It's always unique and original. Investigations for print are very different than for television. The mindset is very, very different. I've done many collaborations with print folks, and it's a challenge because our mindset is different. One of the things I always say, the wonderful thing about print is that you can get into the weeds of a story. You can flesh out all the details, which is fabulous. In television, we don't have that luxury. We basically can make maybe 1-2 points in a story. And in television, it's all about the visuals. Good television is about the visuals. 60 Minutes, if you guys watch 60 Minutes, is brilliant at this. What we do in television is we look for moments. So right when we begin researching, we think in a visual way. Everything, as we're gathering documents, as we're looking for characters. A good character for print is not necessarily going to be a good character for television, because it's not just what they say, it's how they say it. It's how they look, unfortunately. You know, if you have a victim that doesn't look sympathetic, it's not going to work for television. Great information. In investigations, we always gather, you know, as investigators, we love to be cooped up in our offices and gathering data and documents. We love documents. But great information can get lost if it's not presented in a compelling way in television. One of my mentors always says is that viewers always remember what they see and what they feel, as opposed to what they're told. And so in television, we use very simple, clear language, and we write to our video. And so I'm going to show you some examples here. Let me just bring this up here. Let me tell you first, let me give you a little setup before I show this video. So this is an example of what I was saying, covering a story that everybody else is covering it and trying to find an original way of doing it. This story is not a hard-hitting investigation by any means, but it just illustrates how we think visually. So we all know about the BP oil spill, one of the biggest environmental disasters this country has seen in a while. So about a month into the oil spill, oil was still gushing. Everyone had been covering the story, obviously. 60 Minutes, we found some of the workers. We exposed what BP had done wrong. I mean, it was incredible reporting from print to television. So about a month and a half into it, my boss says to me, "What can we do? We got to come up with a story, an investigative story." I thought, God, everything's been done. I don't know what to do. But thinking, because I'm a very highly visual person, thinking television-wise, I thought, how can we approach this story in a way that hasn't been approached before? So I'm about to show you the idea that I came up with here. Can everyone see that up there?
And just how big is this spill? By some estimates, it's now roughly the size of South Carolina. But on the surface, looks can be deceiving. The true scope can only be seen through the lens of a special infrared camera. Our chief investigative correspondent, Armin Katan, has this exclusive report.
3,000 feet above the Gulf of Mexico, an hour by seaplane off the coast of Louisiana, at the site of the Deepwater disaster. On the surface, what appears to the naked eye to be an expanse of deep blue water, marked by boats on the scene of the massive spill. But now look, it's the very same area, shot exclusively for CBS News, with an infrared camera. The Gulf surface, dark and ominous, as far as the camera eye can see. That darkness is oil.
there's a lot of oil in that region right there.
Chris Zappa is an oceanographer at Columbia University.
How can you tell that it's oil?
Because it's reflecting at a cooler temperature than the open ocean over here.
Just yesterday, CBS News spent 3 hours flying over the spill zone, matching shots from our camera with those taken by Rob Raymer of FLIR, a company that makes this infrared camera similar to the ones used by the military.
The thermal camera actually shows the extent of all of the oil, not just the thick, heavy crude that we can see with our eyes, but also the very thin layer of oil sheen.
From the air, the oil-slick waters stretch for hundreds of miles, but the camera can only show what's on the surface.
So we can't tell anything about how deep this oil patch is.
The federal government now estimates as much as 39 million gallons worth of oil has poured into the Gulf since the Deepwater Horizon rig collapsed. Zappa says it's clear from these pictures the cleanup booms are simply overmatched.
Given what you're seeing here, how successful is this cleanup operation?
Not too successful. You can see that it's filling back in behind the ship.
And look at this. The way the wind is forming these ribbons of crude in the wake of a cleanup ship. That means the oil is on the move. An even more ominous sign for some of our nation's most precious coastline. Armin Katayan, CBS News, New York.
In other news, the holiday weekend getaway.
So that's a simple story, just in terms of, you know, I was thinking visually, everybody's done everything in their dog in this story. What could I do that's different? And I had the idea, well, maybe I could go up with a helicopter and look at it. And I thought, well, what am I going to see? And then I realized I'd used these infrared cameras before on stories about the oil industry. And so I just inquired if, you know, the refinery industry. So I thought this might be an idea. Here's an interesting thing about this story. This story, if you watched it, everything except the video with the infrared camera and the interview, the correspondent Armin Katayan is who I work with, our chief investigative correspondent Armin, the interview that was sitting down, all the other video, I shot myself. I shot it using this camera right here. You can believe that. The reason why I bring this up is because nowadays everybody's being asked to shoot video, even us at the network level. You know, and we're considered the big dogs. We're, you know, back in the day, which wasn't too long ago, we used to go out, we'd have two cameramen, two audio producer, associate producer, correspondent. Now, this story, it was just me and this camera. And that was it. And just to give you a little quick story on that, the day that we were supposed to shoot this, it was actually the day before we actually shot it. I had my photographer with me, and the weather was really, really bad, and the helicopter pilot said to me, we can't go up, it's too dangerous. So I said, okay, fine. I called New York, and I said, we can't shoot the story. It's too dangerous. And they said, fine, we'll do it tomorrow. And they said, only problem is we have to pull your photographer because BP was holding some press conference. And I said, well, who's going to shoot it tomorrow? And they said, you can. You can shoot it yourself. Now, I'm not a photographer. I mean, I'm an experienced producer, so I have an eye, but all that video I shot on my own. So the reason why I bring that up is that if you're asked to go out and shoot something, don't be scared. I mean, I'm going to tell you, I was sweating. I didn't have a tripod, so I literally was holding up the camera with my arm so I could get a steady shot looking out the helicopter. I mean, it was difficult. It was extremely, extremely difficult. But now I shoot everything. I go out there, and at first I was a little apprehensive being, you know, with the network, showing up with this little camera, you know, here I am. Didn't think it looked very professional, but now it, you know, because the video looks so amazing, it's not difficult. So don't be intimidated if you're asked to do that. The other thing that I want to point out with this story is transparency. We can't talk about investigations without talking about being transparent. That's the most important thing. Whenever you're doing a story, if you noticed in this story, there were some weaknesses with the infrared camera. It didn't show the depth of the oil. So we made sure that we pointed that out. So there's also, if you do any stories using statistics or data, I'm always very careful if there's some major snafu of some sort, I always make sure to point it out, with the weakness in the information. I'm going to show you another video here. So this story came, just to give you an example of how we as television folk can take something that could be very boring and make it come to life. So there had been a number of folks getting sick from food poisoning, a lot of incidents. And one of our, I didn't produce this story, one of my coworkers did, but she had found a GAO report, a congressional report, that had talked about how oversight of the food industry is very scattered. Now, she could have done that story and just shown the report and had some talking heads. But I'm going to show you what she ended up doing, which was a very clever...
50 feet away, the USDA inspected the packing facility.
Don't watch, everyone.
It was supposed to...
Really?
Tina.
Don't watch. Okay, here we go. Watch how she put this together.
Those tainted eggs we mentioned earlier have a lot of people asking, how do I know my food is safe? Government agencies are supposed to be regulating the food supply, but taken together, they make up an alphabet soup of oversight. A recipe, Chief Investigative Correspondent Armin Katayan reports, that can lead to confusion and contamination.
Estimates are 76 million Americans get sick from foodborne illnesses every year. 325,000 sick enough to end up in the hospital. Last year, the number of salmonella cases for one strain was one-third higher than a decade ago.
It's so frustrating to know that nothing ever gets done.
Jeff Elmer's mother died 2 years ago after getting salmonella poisoning from peanut butter.
To find out it was something that could have been prevented, you feel cheated, you feel angry.
Angry at a bewildering food safety system filled with gaps and overlaps. 15 federal agencies spending more than $2 billion a year to enforce at least 30 different laws. The key agencies, the USDA, which oversees meat and poultry, and the FDA, everything else.
It seems nobody bears any responsibility when things go bad.
Just check out a local grocery store where logic seems in short supply.
Take a look at this. Beef broth made in a plant regulated by the USDA, which inspects every day. But chicken broth made in a plant regulated by the FDA, which is inspected once every 5 years.
In the frozen food aisle, cheese pizza is regulated by the FDA. Pepperoni pizza? Well, that's the USDA. The fish? Well, that's FDA. Except one, catfish, that's USDA. And that USDA seal on a carton of eggs doesn't mean they're safe. It means they've been checked for size and shape.
The result, contaminated spinach from California, peanuts from Georgia, and last
month, eggs from Iowa that sickened more than 1,600 people.
Multiple agencies really just are pointing fingers at each other rather than actually providing consumer protections.
Here's how that protection failed in Iowa. The FDA was supposed to inspect the hen houses, but never did. 50 feet away, the USDA inspected the packing facility every day. What was not allowed inside the hen house were outside. Investigators later discovered an 8-foot pile of manure.
The USDA refused to speak to us on camera, but in a statement said, this incident exemplifies the critical need to make significant improvements in the food safety system.
A bill to overhaul the entire food safety system has been held up by partisan bickering in the Senate for over a year.
How does that make any sense?
Only adding to Elmer's pain.
People's lives hang in the balance on this bill.
As questions about the safety of what we eat only grow. Armin Katayan, CBS News, New York.
So I love that story because it's such a great example of what we do really well in taking something that could have been super boring and made it come to life. And so in going back to what I was saying earlier about the moments, and that's how we approach stories in a very different way. I mean, obviously gathering the information, the data, and the facts are critical, but then also how are we going to present that? And we can do that in unique ways by finding memorable characters. Again, going back to 60 Minutes, that's what they've perfected, getting people who can speak in an eloquent way that makes you just want to sit and listen to them. We do it with unique stand-ups, which is what you saw. I don't know how many of you work in television, but the stand-up is Armin, who was there in the food aisle holding up all these foods. I mean, to me, that was just very, very powerful. And we could have just said that and shown video of this report, but I thought that was a very creative way of doing it. One of the other tools that we use in television, and that obviously we love, besides data and documents, is hidden camera, which is my specialty. I do a lot of hidden camera. I love it. And the way that we do hidden camera has evolved over the years, just like everything, as the internet has evolved and changed our industry. It's changed with hidden camera. And I'm going to explain after I show you this video. So here's another video. I want you to pay attention because this, one of the things I'm going to talk about, which I think we can't talk about investigations unless we talk about legal issues, because it's not only as television folks do we think visually, but we're always in the back of our mind thinking, okay, is this going to get us sued? Are we being fair? Are we being accurate? And so, and part of that, when we use hidden cameras, there's huge legal questions. So what I want you to watch when you watch this story is the use of the hidden camera. And then the other thing is, another technique that we use in television besides memorable characters, creative stand-ups, the graphics that you saw in the story, in the food story, if you saw at the beginning, you know, we had a grocery store and the fonts were at the top of the grocery store. We use those kinds of things. The other thing that we also do is, this next story is a great example of that. It was pitched to us by one of our local affiliates. We could have done the story, just talked about it, and you know, and had talking heads again. But one of the things that we do in television, and we do this in print as well, I think, is we decided to test something out. So hidden cameras and testing and actually trying something out to see what happens. And I'm sort of setting you up here, but watch this, and then we'll talk about it here.
This year marks the 50th anniversary of the first Xerox machines, and it's hard to imagine an office without a copier. But the latest models are creating a major security threat for anyone who uses them, and very few people are aware of it. CBS News has been looking into this for several months now. Here's our chief investigative correspondent, Armin Katayan.
A warehouse in New Jersey filled with 6,000 used copy machines, ready to be sold. And almost every one of them holds a secret.
That's it?
That's the hard drive.
Nearly every digital copier built since 2002 contains one of these, a hard drive. Like the one on your personal computer, it stores an image of every document scanned, copied, or emailed by the machine. In the process, turning an office staple into a digital time bomb, packed with highly personal or sensitive data.
We might find as many as 20,000 documents on it.
If you're in the identity theft business, this has got to be some kind of pot of gold.
Social security numbers, birth certificates, bank records, income tax forms, that information I would think would be very valuable.
John Johnson and Sacramento-based company Digital Copier Security developed software that can scrub all the data on hard drives. He's been trying to warn people about the potential risk with no luck.
Nobody wants to step up and say, we see the problem. We need to solve it.
So we went with Johnson into this warehouse, one of 25 across the country, to see how hard it would be to buy a used copier loaded with documents. Turns out, it's pretty easy.
I get equipment in all day, every single day.
Johnson picked four machines based on price and the number of pages printed. In less than 2 hours, his selections were packed and loaded onto a truck. The cost? About $300 each.
Come on back.
Until we unpacked and plugged them in, we had no idea where the copiers came from or what we'd find. We didn't even have to wait for the first one to warm up.
We've got some documents here on the glass. This machine came from the city of Buffalo, New York, police, sex crimes division. This machine has 249,000 copies on it, total copies. A prints has 42,000 prints on it. It's also used as a fax machine.
It took Juntanen about 30 minutes to pull the hard drives out of the copiers. Then, using a forensic software program available free on the internet, he ran a scan, downloading tens of thousands of documents in less than 12 hours. The results were stunning. From the sex crimes unit, detailed domestic violence complaints and a list of wanted sex offenders. On a second machine from the Buffalo PD narcotics unit, we found a list of targets in a major drug raid. The third machine from a New York construction company spit out design plans for a building near Ground Zero in Manhattan. 95 pages of pay stubs with names, addresses, and social security numbers, and $40,000 in copy checks. But it wasn't until we hit print on the fourth machine from a New York insurance company that we obtained the most disturbing documents. 300 pages of individual medical records, everything from drug prescriptions to blood test results to a cancer diagnosis, a potentially serious breach of federal privacy law.
You're talking about potentially ruining somebody's life where they could suffer serious social repercussions.
Ira Winkler is a former analyst for the National Security Agency and a leading expert on digital security.
You have to take some basic responsibility and know that these copiers are actually computers that need to be cleaned up.
The Buffalo PD and the New York Construction Company declined comment on our story. As for Affinity, they issued this statement that said in part, "We are taking the necessary steps to ensure that none of our customers' personal information remains on other previously leased copiers, and that no personal information will be released inadvertently in the future." Ed McLaughlin is president of Sharp Imaging, the digital copier company.
Has the industry failed, in your mind, to inform the general public of the potential risks involved with a copier?
I think yes. In general, the industry has failed.
In 2008, Sharp commissioned a survey on copier security that found 60% of Americans don't know that copiers store images on a hard drive. Sharp tried to warn consumers about the threat, but
it's falling on deaf ears, or people don't feel it's that important, or we'll take care of it later.
All the major manufacturers told us they offer security or encryption packages on their products. McLaughlin showed us this one from Sharp that automatically erases an image from the hard drive.
How much does that component, that option, cost on a machine like this?
$500.
But evidence keeps piling up in warehouses that many businesses are unwilling to pay for such protection, and that the average American is completely unaware of the dangers posed by digital copiers. The day we visited that New Jersey warehouse, two shipping containers packed with used copiers were headed overseas, loaded with secrets, on their way to unknown buyers in Argentina and Singapore. Armin Katayan, CBS News, New York.
Okay, everyone saw the hidden camera that was in that story? That was all shot using an iPhone. This is what I'm talking about, the evolution of hidden camera. I'm used to, hidden camera in my purse, or, we have all these, we have hidden camera in water bottles, and I love that kind of stuff. But now, we're just using iPhones. We literally walked in there and we just occasionally held the iPhone. No one questioned it. And that's how we got that video inside. Having said that, in part of the handout that you guys got, it gives you a rundown about hidden camera. There are two kinds of states. There's one-party state and two-party states. So when you're shooting hidden camera, you've got to know the laws. Before we do any hidden camera, I have to talk to three lawyers at CBS to get approval, because we have to look at the state laws and find out can we shoot hidden camera or can't we. And in the handout that I gave, you'll see that there are 12 states in the country that are considered two-party states. So what that means is if you're shooting hidden camera, let me rewind. A one-party state, if you're shooting hidden camera, you only need the consent of one person. So typically, that's the person who's shooting the video.
So if I'm shooting hidden camera, I get my consent. I can videotape you without your knowledge. If it's a two-party state, that means I have to ask your approval to videotape you. Unfortunately, Florida, you know, we're headquartered in New York, but I'm based here in Florida, and unfortunately, Florida is a two-party state. So hidden camera is very, very tricky here. So anytime I'm doing hidden camera, I always try to go to New York, or I try to do it in other states besides Florida. This story, this copier story, posed a lot of legal issues for us. And so this is the last thing that I'm going to talk about, which is the legalities of doing an investigative story. We purchased these copier machines, so we own them when we purchased them. The question was, do we own the material that the folks left behind? And particularly with the medical company that you saw there, there was HIPAA information. We had people's birth certificates, social security numbers, we had their income statements, anything that you could think of that people do. That's why I'm now very careful of anything I photocopy at work. Well, not that I ever photocopied personal stuff, but a lot of people do. We had all kinds of information. And so it was a big challenge for us legally about how to handle these documents. And the lengths that we went to was pretty incredible. We took the documents, we created encrypted files. Only one person on staff was able to have access to it. Out of the four companies that we had the information, we reached out to all of them and told them that we wanted to return, even though they wouldn't talk to us, that we wanted to return the hard drives. And three of them accepted the hard drives. One of them didn't. I don't know why. And just so that you know, the health company that you saw there, they ended up having to notify all of their patients that there was a breach of their private information. And they ended up spending about $5 million to clean up the mess. And it was all because, you know, we obtained this Xerox machine. So just in closing, what, you know, we're, as television folks, always thinking about creative ways to tell a story. I think in print, you know, just sort of always just think about the information and who, what experts you're going to talk to or what victims. In television, we go a step further, and that's really trying to figure out how we can approach the story in a different way, visually, and that's compelling and that will draw folks in. That's about it. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Pia. And you know, I just wanted to sort of mention that, you know, there was a time when, you know, hardened print reporters would sort of frown on hearing the kind of presentation that Pia would have just made and say, well, that's just television. I don't have to do that. But actually, many of the things she said are really good ways of thinking about framing even a print story. I mean, I'm a veteran of having written, you know, 3,000-word cover stories for Business Week and that kind of thing. But still, you want to try to visualize what you're writing about and actually even be sort of cinematic at times in how you go about it. I mean, you heard Manny talk about, you know, making sure you have a narrative and you have a protagonist and all those sorts of things. You're telling a story. And many of the things she talked about, even simplifying, kind of trying to get in your head and being able to communicate not just to your editor or your producer, but to your audience in a very simple terms, the way she mentioned, is something that's a very good skill. Speaking of copiers, we have copies of the handout for those of you who came in late and didn't get one over at the corner of the table here. Feel free to come up and get one. And I will tell you a little bit about my organization and give you some more practical tips on trying to get some of these stories done. And then we'll take a short break and go for questions. I'm Keith Epstein. I'm managing editor of the Center for Public Integrity, which is the, as is one of these organizations, like the one that McNally represents, that's regional in this area.
Is the grandma organization?
We are. Yeah, McNally likes to refer to ours as the grandmother organization of all nonprofits, because in fact we were here 20 years ago before we existed. 20 years ago before we even, you know, there was this sort of sense of a need to carry the torch forward for this kind of important work that people aren't doing. You know, you've heard you've had other panelists here talk about, hint at some of the decline that we all know is happening out there in commercial news media. There was a day when investigative producer for CBS News wouldn't have to be shooting video, wouldn't have to use that big camera and be kind of scared to death. What if I go up there and I take the shot and it doesn't quite work out right? There was a day at the Miami Herald where Manny is. I mean, they're still doing some great work, great investigative work. But there was a time when the team there, a dedicated team of investigative reporters, was quite much more significant. And even in different parts of South Florida, dedicated to that task. No more. But we're doing, organizations like McNally's and ours are doing more than carrying the torch. We're finding new ways of going about doing this reporting, of getting it distributed, of getting it recognized across, in platforms, and also coming up with new models for bringing in revenue. So it's not always the traditional way for an organization like ours or most nonprofits going out to big foundations and wealthy people and saying, gee, here's this important thing we do, please support us. So though we were founded in 1989, we have grown tremendously. We're based in Washington, D.C. We have very national and through part of our organization called the International Consortium for Investigative Journalists. We do international, global stories of significance to everybody on the planet. And many of those are environmental. And in fact, our domestic staff here we are the largest investigative newsroom, nonprofit newsroom in the U.S. We have probably one of the largest teams of investigative reporters dedicated solely to environmental topics. I was executive editor after I left Business Week, where I was on the investigative team. I was executive editor of the Huffington Post Investigative Fund, which gave us some wonderful opportunities to experiment with both distribution and how we went about doing things. And we merged with the Center for Public Integrity in January. And the goal is like many of the goals that many of us have in our hearts, which is to find out about things out there that people don't necessarily know about, systemic problems preferably, and identify where there have been failures by institutions, by regulatory agencies, that sort of thing, and let the world know about it, as much of the world as you can reach in as compelling a way as you can. There's been some mention of collaboration. There was a time when you wouldn't think of going out and working with a partner, be it television or another competitor. I mean, early in my career, I worked for the Miami Herald in Broward County, and that was a time when the Herald had a major initiative. The goal was to decimate the Fort Lauderdale Sun Sentinel, and they were off. The Herald set up offices throughout Broward, and if I wasn't covering story in Miramar, it was Pembroke Pines or East or Hollywood, and the plan didn't work out. But there was no way that anybody at the Herald would even talk to a reporter from the Sun Sentinel. And I remember being quite envious of one Sun Sentinel reporter in particular. So you wouldn't even give the time of day, really. Now we're in a situation where we collaborate all the time. P and I have been talking last night about some possibilities. All after this presentation, I'm going to be pitching Manny on something that I think he's going to be very interested in. And in fact, McNally, is her organization is somebody who's cooperated with us on several occasions, and we're working on a major project now. So I'll just give you a little sense of some of the work we've done in recent times. And these are things that if you are a reporter or an editor, your organization can do as well. And even whether it's grabbing pieces of these or doing the larger effort. We focused on, we're one of the first to have written on Solyndra loan guarantee to Solyndra, which is now, it suddenly became national news, wrote about red flags that had been raised at the Department of Energy as that proposal for loan guarantee was making its way through the system. In fact, our lead reporter on that, Ronnie Green, used to work for the Herald, was a star down here. But it wasn't just him. He was working with a guy named Matt Mosk, who is a producer at ABC News with Brian Ross. And as you may have noticed in hearing Pia talk, we now are in a time where a producer is not just somebody who is a booker, not just somebody who thieves from print journalists to get something on air, but actually somebody who's engaged, who's actually engaged and doing the reporting as well. And Matt Mosk has a print background, and he's made this move to the hybrid world of being able to actually visualize things both for print, for the web, and on television. So these are some of the stories we've done. We've got one coming up that we're fairly excited about. I can say something about. We're taking a look at some of the 21 years after the Clean Air Act amendments, and looking at problems where there are serious problems with pollution from specific polluters around the country, and why that has persisted so many years later. And we're doing that in partnership with a number of people. We're doing that in partnership with NPR, and we're doing that with organizations like McNally's and in other parts of the country where there are small regional nonprofits. We're also looking at other things that maybe sort of go beyond this notion that the questions surrounding government subsidies for clean energy, but you know, where not just the question of whether that's working, whether it indeed effectively spurs new industries that this country needs as a matter of decided policy, but you know, are there instances of cronyism involved? Are there, you know, is there a political or business aspect to this? There is in fact a gray side of green, and you know, while the political dialogue sometimes veers off in a different direction, one of the things that we're looking at rather consistently is, you know, are these programs working the way they're supposed to, but are they also, you know, are there connections to bundlers for political campaigns? You know, is there some self-dealing involved in these things? Is some of the old-fashioned politics, money and politics, getting in the way of the fulfillment of these lofty ambitions of, for instance, moving towards developing alternative sources of energy? And you know, we often mix politics with the other topics we're doing. So I'm going to leave it there. Who we are, I don't want to take too much time with that, because I think probably what would be most useful to everybody here is to talk about this all sounds really great, all these wonderful projects that this guy gets to do with this, you know, with a bunch of very skilled journalists with magazine and TV and radio backgrounds at this nonprofit center based in Washington, D.C., but I've got to go back on Monday, and how do I accomplish this? Which hopefully you've picked up from all of the speakers up here to some degree. I mean, I used to, when I was a young reporter at the Herald, I used to go off to conferences like this one, and like investigative reporters and editors, IRA conferences. And I'd get all, like most people who would go to those, I'd get very excited. My goodness, I'd come back with, you know, this long list of story ideas, things I wanted to do. And Monday morning would come along, I'd go into the office, and, you know, there were the three or four or five things that the editor wanted done. And were due, you know, in a day or two. And this is, make me sound a little old here, but this is pre-internet, you know. This is just back in the days when the Herald wanted to beat the Fort Lauderdale Sun Sentinel, and there was a, you know, you didn't want to miss a story. Now that's compounded by all of the things that we face. So what do you do when you're in that situation? You come back, you know, because it is the reality is it's getting harder. There's more to do. Some of you probably have to blog in addition to your other duties. And if you are a public affairs person in the audience, or you're in the weeds in policy for an interest group or a government agency, whatever role you have, it's useful to be thinking about a lot of the things we're talking about up here, including this, because if you're sensitive to what reporters and editors are facing and the ways they have to go about selling their executive producers and editors on stories, then you'll be able to pitch your agenda a little more effectively. So one thing that makes a lot of sense to do is get ahead on that other work on your plate. Get ahead on, and I don't mean necessarily filing it early. I mean do this stealthily. Buy yourself some time. Put a little time in the bank. So that if, in fact, some of my other suggestions don't work out, and you can't on the up and up say, hey, I need some time, at least get ahead on what you need to do. and have it done so you can carve out that extra time it takes, because this reporting is very resource intense, does take a lot of time, and there aren't a lot of shortcuts, because even if you are lucky enough to have a source who will guide you, or you have a data mindset, as McNally advocates having very smartly, you still need to check that data. You still need to make sure it shows you what you think it shows. And as Manny emphasized, at the end of the day, you need to figure out how are you going to tell that story. Who's your protagonist? How are you going to find it? Just finding a protagonist can be a massive headache. And my favorite story on that was probably at Business Week, where we spent several months on a story, and about businesses that basically were targeting the poor in various kinds, new sorts, not traditional payday lenders so much as sort of this new evolution of very sophisticated businesses that could identify people who don't have a lot of money and charge them a lot of interest for various things. And in doing that, we needed to tell the story as people's emphasized up here. You need a narrative, and you need a person, and you want to have humanity in your story. But on a magazine, weekly magazine, as well as TV, it's not necessarily that any person will do, even if that person seems to be a great candidate for illustrating your point, because you've also got to be thinking about art, and you've got to be thinking, how does this person look? And I remember we had several what we thought were perfect candidates for protagonists, for people to tell our story through the eyes of those people, and there was somebody in the organization had a problem with one of them. We can't put that person has a gap tooth, a gap in their teeth, we can't put them on the cover. Lots of things that you wouldn't think would matter. And finding each one of these people takes time. It took a few weeks, actually, to find somebody who would work for the story, also look good on the cover, also work with the narrative well. And so, bottom line, all of this takes time. You've got to find it, bank it. Try to find a way to bank it for yourself. Look at the juggling as an investment. When I was at the Herald and I was coming back from IRE conferences and so forth, and I was a young reporter and I had all these things to do and hardly time to sleep sufficiently. There didn't seem to be any time to do extra stories. And I just squeezed out those extra hours. And I wanted to write about links between the Seminoles and white-collar crime, for instance. And you just have to find, if you can't convince the editor you need the time, just fit a little in. And then you can at least get to that stage where, Manny talked about the importance of framing what you think your story is to pitch your editor. Sometimes you don't have to report the whole story or write the whole story to get to that point. You just have to get to enough. You get enough preliminary reporting done that you can say, "Look, here's what I know. Here's what I think I can find out, and I think I can find somebody, or I already have found somebody to tell this story through." And that may be enough to convince your editor or your producer to give you, a little more time to accomplish that. We've heard people talk here about, thinking about doing it on multimedia platforms. That was true in our case at the Center for Public Integrity. We had a major investigation of problems at oil refineries, where there have been many accidents, frequently recurring problems, not just the ones that make the news, but even small fires and small equipment breakdowns that can be precursors to major disasters. And we also found out there are some very serious chemicals at many of the nation's refineries, including one called hydrofluoric acid, which has unique properties for a toxic gas. It moves very quickly and could be released into nearby communities, threatening millions of people across the country. So in developing the story, we not only had sort of the traditional print versions of this story, which were online and in some print partners, some of those stories being 2,000, 3,000 words, but also interactive multimedia pieces where people could look up what the situation was in communities near them, and they could just sort of scroll over their community and find out, how much of that toxic acid was there, or whether the refinery had had problems before. And then we also did videos. I'm going to share one I'm going to share one with you. And this is really, I want to share this one because this is an example of how you can, you know, how you, if you get people in your stories, you know, how much more compelling that can be. And people will notice. This video I'm about to show you isn't that long, but it sort of went viral on the web, drew much more attention to this series. Because you think, refineries. Well, how much interest can there be in refineries? Several things propelled this story forward, and this is one of them. This is a contract worker who worked at a refinery, and across this country, many places, if an accident happens at a refinery, contract workers are not among those counted. And if something terrible happens to them, as happened to this man, they're not even entitled to the same kind of benefits. Many of the undocumented contract laborers are not covered for very, very expensive medical procedures.
The last thing I remember was when they was pushing me into the ambulance, and that's about it. And then I wake up 9 hours later in San Antonio. The last thing I remember was when they was pushing me into the ambulance, and that's about it. And then I wake up 9 hours later in San Antonio.
When he woke up in the hospital that day in February 2008, Jose Herrera knew his life was forever changed. He had been horribly burned by hot oil in an accident at the Citgo refinery in Corpus Christi, Texas, where he was working as a contractor.
I was in there for pretty good 10, you know, between 5 and 10 minutes, and a scalpel hanging out there. Again, spray out with 550 degrees oil. A couple of guys, they walked me down the stairs all the way to the ground, to the closest shower, safety shower, to cut my clothes off and get cold water on me to try to chill out the heat and that I had in my face and my body. You know, it's just a real slow process, painful and slow, because it takes a long time to heal.
Tell me about your chin. You said earlier you don't have any feeling.
I don't have no feeling. All you can see the seams are here. Where they had to do a double seam. They put stitches in the inside. You can feel it. If you go like this, you can feel the inside stitches. And here, all the way around it. And it's pretty bad. But I had to leave, I guess, like that. I got no choice.
What's worth noting about this, I think, is so we have this very complicated investigation. If you read the print version of this story, I mean, it's all the things a traditional investigation is, and yet this video is very simple. Not many different scenes, no animation, just a very simple. Here's the message, and I think it had a compelling effect and drew attention to the whole thing. So it helps to think that way. Some other things you can do. Think about doing what you're doing as multiple parts, because in many of our newsrooms, many of our organizations, and this we're subject to some of the same problems, because we're all dealing with the web. We're dealing with trying to feel immediate to people and relevant to what's going on at a given time, at the same time as we want to pursue these longer term stories. So think about the possibility for doing what you're doing in multiple parts, thereby creating a little more quantity. Your news director or your editor, you know, may actually be more positively inclined towards that. In addition, though, that can be a better storytelling method for the web. If you have a narrative that sustains itself over smaller chapters, it can be a very effective way of doing it. Localize the national story if you're looking for ideas and the press is very local, or you work for a very specialty publication. look at that national story and be thinking about, you know, how might this apply to what we care about or where, you know, our mission is. Very often, whether it's a Supreme Court decision, and there are Supreme Court decisions regularly that affect the environment in some way, you know, think about some aspect of that that might be worth localizing. What's the impact of that decision on people? What's the, you know, and, you know, talk to the specialists, talk to lawyers and organizations involved to find that out. Comb lists. I mean, these records that McNally showed you in this handout lists some very good sources for reviewing lists. Look for things that are in your area. Really comb through those for something local. There are all kinds of things like that. One big thing that also think about the way culturally news organizations function. Editors and news directors and so on love anniversaries. I, as a reporter, always hated anniversaries because the whole idea of investigative reporting is you're zigging when other people are zagging. You're zagging when you're zigging. It's too early to get that expression right. But, you know, you're trying to be where they aren't. You're trying to go out there and find out what other people don't know. And yet anniversaries can work for you because you know the other people are thinking that way. And very often what seems to have been, you know, reporters will all swarm like lemmings around a big event. BP oil spill is one of our most recent big examples. And then there are year later anniversary stories. And there might be a few in next year as well. But people sort of fade away. And there are all the hearings and there are all the findings of commissions and so on and so forth. But in fact, what one often finds, and I'm sure this will be true in this case too, there are problems that persist. There are things that have not been resolved. And these continue to be important stories. I did a series myself on transportation tragedies that recur for want of, you know, known established safety fixes recommended by the National Transportation Safety Board. I did this years ago. Somebody came to me about, you know, 2 years ago and said, you know, wanted advice on how to do this and whether they had thought they should do it again because it had been done. And I broke another one of the things that I feel strongly about. I feel our work should be very original. You know, we all want to be original. We'll be the first to discover something. We want to do that meritorious thing. But sometimes it's actually worth going back and doing something again because the problem is still there or a form of it is. And it's worth that. That's an opportunity to go back in and return to the scene and perform that public service, which ultimately we're all about, which is identifying things that are wrong out there, that are broken, and explaining why it matters and what could be done about it. We've talked a lot about collaboration. I want to save time for a little break and questions and answers, so I'm going to wrap this up quickly. But one important thing that you've heard us all mention here is collaboration. And it's a way, it's not just, oh, it's fun to work together, which it is. But not always, because it can also be very much like any other relationship, like a marriage or something. I mean, you have to, there are times when you compromise. You have to understand another person who operates very differently from you. A network culture can be very different from a traditional newspaper culture. And I've, you know, brought, you know, one of my reporters used to work for the Houston Chronicle, and he's very much the hardened, you know, he fits the stereotype of the hardened investigative reporter every which way. You know, when I first knew him, didn't even want to think about TV. Another very good investigative reporter, somebody Manny knows, in fact. I just cannot get him to focus on the, you know, on the idea of social media or Twitter. You know, but you know, if collaboration has become this thing that doesn't just allow you to get it done, but you're leveraging resources further. I mean, if one of our reporters can work with a producer at CBS or ABC, and that producer is, as Pia is, and as Matt Mosk is, somebody who's actually very engaged in the stories and reports them and carries the camera around and everything else, that enables us to do many things. First of all, we can get a better story because, you know, you suddenly have double the size of the teaming on that story and the expertise and the experience. And there's sort of an exponential effect, I think, when people do work together. There are a lot of loners. There are people who like to work alone, and Manny said that's one of the things you need to figure out. Are you going to do the story alone, or are you going to do it with somebody? I find very often that you get so much more accomplished when there is more than one person on a story, and it's actually a good thing to do, and people can complement each other. And then, of course, you can reach many more people. You can do a better story. you can have greater distribution, and you can also get through to sources better. Because if you go to sources, whether they be at the EPA or wherever, and you're saying, okay, I'm calling on behalf of the Center for Public Integrity, and we're doing a collaboration with NPR and 10 investigative nonprofits around the country, and we've got a couple of parts that we're doing of this series with Slate magazine, some doors open that wouldn't ordinarily open, and they open also for some of the smaller organizations that are part of this. And so that's a very beneficial thing all around.